Hello and welcome to Rule of Carnage. This is one of those videos that you might also be listening to with your ears. And we are going to spend some time talking about designing better miniature games. And we're going to spend what Glenn believes will only be 30 minutes talking about some inalienable truths of miniature game design. What are the things that will always be true, the rules that always exist, the factors that must be present when you're designing a miniature game? There might not be any, but we're going to see if there are some and see if we can find any disprovals of the fact that there might be some inalienable truths. This is sort of the counterpoint to the rules that should not be, but always are. This is the rules that always will be. Amen.
Yeah, I think we're sort of fairly, I wouldn't say obsessed, but we're heavily interested in seeing if we can sort of do things in tabletop miniatures games that you probably shouldn't be able to do.
And also we're two massive nerds and therefore definitions matter. And we have been trying to define miniature games for nigh on 50 episodes of this, 50 recordings of this podcast.
Yeah, and I think a while ago we were talking about, obviously, A Billion Suns plays across more than one tabletop. Mm-hmm. And early on within the A Billion Suns design system, there's trying to work out a way of doing the looping circular table. And we at least figured out how to let you play on a circular table or a hexagonal table or any shape table you like. Then we were having a conversation about, well, can you play on any surface? Does it have to be a flat surface? And sure enough, somebody put A Billion Suns on the side of their fridge.
So
So those seem to be like things you could definitely had to have with a tabletop miniatures game, in that you had to have a table with a top to play it, but apparently not. So I think we started wondering about what sorts of things you assume to be true, and there must be some of them. There must be some rules we can't break. Possibly, and we're looking to try and figure out what some of those are. So obviously tables don't have to be a set size or a set number of tables,
right?
Do they have to be some sort of set shape to them? I know that you can play A Billion Suns like on a round or hexagonal table, and you can play it on a breakfast bar and it chair, but are there some, I mean, there are some limitations to what sort of surface you can play A Billion Suns on?
No, I don't think so. Like Necromunda, for example, proves that the more three-dimensional a table, the better. And there's a game, I've forgotten the name of it right now, where they ran a Kickstarter, and it's a miniature skirmish game with a cube that's metal, that's stuck together with magnets, and then you play your it's like a kind of what's that thing? Ender's Game, like the sort of training routine that they do at the in the first half of Ender's Game, the sort of zero gravity fight out. So I think like both of those things, like a classic and a new, they prove that like part of the charm of these three-dimensional, fully rendered miniature environments is that you can have an incredible variety of spaces in which to play, and ups and downs. And quite a lot of miniature games don't actually deal with the third dimension in any meaningful way. They abstract it or what have you. But I think that once you are excited by the idea of three-dimensionality, and you are excited by the idea of objectives or deployment zones which are relative to points on the table rather than relative to edges of the table, then I think you eliminate any need for size, space, shape, edges, spherical thing. Like, it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, and absolutely. I think that the question about whether there needs to be a tabletop and the tabletop needs to be a given shape is ultimately a question about whether or not you can balance a miniature on it, and if you can magnetize miniatures to other things. And then it starts, and then the other big question,
and that's frankly a convenience more than anything. Like, we've both played plenty of games where we go, yeah, the goblin is, we know he's just there, I can't get him to stand, but if you like, I'll put this dice to show where he is and we'll measure from that.
Absolutely. And I suppose if we're going for the big ones right off the bat in relation to a tabletop miniatures game, given that you don't need a tabletop, the next question is, do you actually need miniatures? You know, given that if you're abstracting a lot of the miniatures down to bases or positions or even points, you know, in the case of Billion Suns, everything is abstracted down to a single point.
So I will fight you with knives on this point that yes, you have to have miniatures. And unfortunately, I will lose this knife fight to many people, including you, who will happily play miniature games without miniatures, because people will play Billion Suns because it's more convenient, or people will play travel versions of games. I myself have play tested Hobgoblin with little cardboard squares because I just needed to like tear a game out really fast. But I think it isn't a tabletop miniature game if it doesn't have any miniatures in it. And I sort of don't mean if you play a game without miniatures in, you are not playing a miniatures game. But if you design a miniatures game without miniatures in mind, then I think you are doing something else, because you're not joining all of the elements together that in my mind are inalienably part of this medium that I enjoy.
So, I mean, I was thinking about this the other day, and I was thinking about, so for example, in Infinity, they have their sort of soup can silhouette from when you're doing shooting. And if you think about a game like Infinity, what that means is that there's the version of the tabletop you look at. And what that actually is it's a sort of filigree facade over the matrix-like reality of that tabletop. And
yeah, it's like hitboxes. It's like hitboxes in video games. Like the sprites can do whatever they want, but the hitbox is the thing that matters.
Yeah, and so in, you know, does Infinity need on any, you know, the miniatures for Infinity are just a thing to put there to look pretty until you try and actually figure out how the game works, and then you may throw that mini in the bin and put a soup.
Yeah, but if you take the minis away from Infinity, it just isn't that game. Like a game is not a set of mechanics that interact on the tabletop. A miniature game at its best is a holistic fantasy experience. It's an enveloping experience that contains both the fantasy that you wish to inhabit and that you want to be part of and you want to be firing in your brain, plus the challenge of engaging with the gaming system, with the social interactions across the table. Like, you know, I mean, with the exception of solo games, I was wondering, like, if you take any of those things away, it's definitely less of a game. Does it cease to become something that is of that medium? I'm not sure. But like, if you took all of the miniatures away from Infinity, it wouldn't tell the same story. It wouldn't have the same flavor on the palette. It wouldn't tell the same stories.
I mean, this is the thing. I can agree that it would have a different feel to it. But only in the way that it would have a different feel to it if I wrote a different setting for it and replaced the miniatures with a sort of set of fantasy miniatures or something of that nature. I don't think it would cease to be that sort of a game. It would just be that sort of a game that had a very different sort of flavor level to it. So the flavor level to it would be bland, you know, rice cakes, because you'd just be playing with transparent soup cans. But I don't think that flavour being beige changes what the game is.
Perhaps, you know? Perhaps what we're wondering about is like where the boundaries of a miniature lies. Because if you tried to play A Billion Suns remembering where all of the ships were without any markers, that clearly wouldn't work. You can use cardboard chits as markers, and if they have little pictures of spaceships on, all the better. One thing that's interesting is I've been researching naval war games. One thing that I've read a couple of times was people say of 1/6,000 scale miniatures, which are teeny tiny little things. I bought a couple of them to have a little look at what they were like. At that scale, people start to say things. I read a couple of times, people said, well, at this point, you may as well just play on a large sheet of like brown packing paper and just mark off the location of the ships with a pencil and then rub them out and then redraw where they are. So that you can sort of imagine like playing in a sort of massive whiteboard sort of situation, like recording the location of the ships as if they were on some kind of, you know, kind of war room wall. And so at that point, like, is that one of these games? Like, the miniature at that point is a pencil drawing that evolves.
I mean, I personally, I think that they are this kind of game. I think that, I mean, personally, I'm repeatedly mildly obsessed with trying to create a certain rule somewhere in a game which actually makes it a necessity to have a physical miniature. Hmm. And you know, it's just, it only has to be one or another, but I like there to be a thing which is like, you know, you can fit through a doorway if the miniature can go through the door without its head coming off, you know, or something of that nature. Just one thing that says, yeah, at one point in this game, you are going to need to care about the shape of the actual physical miniature because it's going to make you do something with it just once. Just so you know, it's one of the things I do like about, you know, we mostly play Gaslands Without Bases. And the thing I like about Gaslands Without Bases is that it totally matters how long your car is. And it totally matters, you know, if you picked up a Mini or some great long Chevy or something. And it's only a little thing, but it changes the gaming experience.
That's interesting, actually. So that's interesting because actually that suggests that having miniatures in war games from a rules perspective is the aberration. And the abstraction is the non-aberration, because people get very crossed about like dark elf ships that have these very long pokey bits that allow you to measure from places that don't feel like you should be able to measure from, or the brief moment where Age of Sigmar didn't have bases, so you could just pile as many Skaven on top of each other as you wanted to. Like, what didn't matter was the miniature. What mattered was the abstraction of the base size. Mm. And actually, Ash Barker's game Gamma Wolves, it phrases this very nicely. It says, when you make a mech, you choose the weight of the mech, and that determines the base size. And once you've got a 40 mil base, your job is to fill that up with mech. And like, that's all it says. It's like, do whatever the hell you want to make a cool thing that describes what's going on there. But like, the only thing that matters is the 40 mil base.
Yeah, and it's
really... But it's really, really important to me because, like, one of the questions that people can rightfully ask is when you're dealing with a subject and you begin to explore it, you'd be like, is this best as a miniature game, or would this be better as a board game, or better as a card game? And in some regards, in some situations, my feeling is, like, the fact that it has miniatures is an input, not an output. Like, one of the things that I want to do is make an assassin game with miniatures, and those two things go into the design, and what comes out has to match those things. Whether I put in the word assassin and the word miniature and the game design process produces this should be a board game about assassins, like, that's incorrect. That's a miscalibrated design process. So for me, because I've been wrestling with this for a naval game that I've been tinkering with, you keep asking, like, does this need miniatures? Like, it's the 1/6000 thing. Like, once you zoom out enough, does it need miniatures, or would it be better as a board game? And I keep looking at it and going, would this be better as a like cardboard chits sort of old style war game? And it's like, well, that's not important. Like, I want to play with miniatures. I myself want to play with little toy boats. So that's an input, not an output.
I mean, the irony, I think, for that, for the way that I feel more and more about tabletop miniatures games in relation to the fact that, you know, you're looking at naval games, is that I do think miniatures on the tabletop are important. I just don't think that these miniatures on the tabletop are important. Mm. I think that the terrain is important. The terrain that blocks line of sight and blocks movement and slows movement. I think that, you know, all of these little guys can be bases. I couldn't really most of the time give...
You can't see why they need to be giant monsters.
It doesn't particularly matter.
But like, the giant church has to be a giant church, or it doesn't function.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, especially if I've got particularly an abstracted line of sight rather than true line of sight, Maybe that's it.
All these years of railing against true line of sight, and that's the only true way of doing a miniatures game, because if it doesn't have true line of sight, what's the purpose in having a model?
Well, that's the thing. Even with abstracted line of sight, I need terrain models, but I don't necessarily, with abstracted line of sight, need an abstracted
terrain system, you also only need footprints of terrain. So,
well, no, if it's a three-dimensional, I still have a base on top of a building, so it needs to be boxes, and I need boxes with holes in that I can push miniatures through and around. And at that point, you know what? I've made a building. So that's a funny thing when you talk about naval games, is that I don't really think that I need soldiers on bases necessarily for most games, but I totally think that I need a building and a set of trees and a swamp and all these sorts of things. And then you're talking about a naval game, which is, well, what's the terrain? I don't know, there might be an iceberg and a push. And it's like, well, no, I just don't even know why in any level you need any kind of miniature. You need a blue roll of wallpaper, and then, yeah, I'm totally fine with you drawing things on and rubbing them out again. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, like I say, I don't think you need those miniatures, but I think you need a three-dimensional thing to put on a tabletop. And I'm very antsy about the idea of things like naval stuff, you know, and at least, you know, with spaceships, you have asteroids and stuff. And I'm really personally very interested in things like space and air flight games that play with the three-dimensional nature of the actual minis. And again, talking about naval games, you showed us that one of the old naval games which suggested that you have tabletops as like islands, and you have the floor as the playing surface, and you put all of your boats on broomsticks, and then you can leave a few stools and stuff and ottomans around the room, and those are reefs, and therefore the ships can't go through those reefs, and then you push a ship from one island to another island, and then it lands soldiers onto that island. Now that is a naval game that I can totally get behind and totally needs miniatures, and I think is absolute genius. Insane possibly, but at least insane genius. So yeah, I'm not sure that miniatures games need miniatures. Mike at least does think that that is an inalienable truth of the genre.
Well, this is maybe me as a product person rather than as an abstract design first person, but like it's an incomplete experience.
I can understand that physically at the tabletop it's a better experience if you have minis, and I don't contest that.
It's whether or not the rule system is asking questions about those objects.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think that the minis are an inalienable truth of these sorts of games.
What else have we got on the list that might be?
And with that, we'll take a quick break.
Whether or not you can do hidden movement with a tabletop miniatures game. Now, there are obviously tabletop miniatures games that do hidden movement, I think. Yep. Is it All Quiet on the Martian Front?
Yeah, that's my favourite example. So that one is an asymmetrical game where one person plays massive Martian tripods stomping around with heat rays, and the other person plays the humans with their little, you know, little machine gun wielding World War One guys and some tanks, but they're quite rubbish. And it deals you out little blip tokens, and so the humans are weak, but they get the opportunity of stealth. And I think it works pretty nicely.
Sure. So there's a couple of questions I think I'd raise on this one. Is if you had a game where you've got hidden movement, therefore everybody has blip tokens,
yep,
and during a particular playthrough of that game, none of those blip tokens ever get revealed, mm-hmm, so you never use a miniature.
Mm-hmm.
And if you hold that it is necessary for somebody to use a miniature on the tabletop for it to be one of these sorts of games, can you therefore have a game that is both one of these sorts of games and a hidden movement game, given the hidden movement game can be played without miniatures and the miniatures game can't be played without miniatures?
I mean, I would consider that design to be a failure, but if you're the sort of person who believes that it would be just fine to play with empty bases or beautifully illustrated coloured tokens instead of units, then ultimately there isn't really any difference in playing with beautifully illustrated flat tank counters and this game that we're just hypothetically describing.
I just mean it's like, you know, if like 9 times out of 10 that game does end up having a bunch of miniatures put onto the tabletop because you almost always find each other, but it so happens that two forces come together who are both interested in playing the full stealth game, and you play out a full stealth.
But I also think that like the design, not to catapult into a hidden movement podcast episode, but like I think the design has to engage with the resolution from. Which it does very nicely in All Quiet on the Martian Front, the resolution from blip of unknown capability to unit with known capability that is probably stronger but more in one way or the other. And if you never reveal these miniatures, then I don't think your design is working, because it's not transporting like tension to payoff.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with you then. I think that's the point to get to. I think the thing with hidden movement is that you need to note the movement upon the tabletop.
Yeah.
And with these sorts of games, that requires you to do something slightly weird and slightly not of this sort of game. So it's like, you know, if you're playing Scotland Yard, a hidden movement game, plenty of the best games of Scotland Yard are one where you never find Mr. X, and that's totally fine because it has this very abstracted notation of movement, and he doesn't have to put a little token down and move it around on the board. That's literally what it's built and designed around. When you do hidden movement with a tabletop miniatures game, you've still got to put something onto the tabletop, because you can't note where a thing is in a tabletop miniatures game, because you know, you'd literally need to measure out the entire table, draw out a millimeter by millimeter grid, and write down incredibly, you know, specific positional notations. You still got to put
that
something.
Sounds very satisfying.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. You still got to physically put something onto the tabletop. And so there's an interesting question as to, even in All Quiet on the Martian Front, how hidden is the hidden? Is that hidden movement? Or is it just non-specific movement? Is it, I know you're in one of these three spots. In Scotland Yard or Fury of Dracula, I do not know where you are.
I know you're in one of 200 spaces. Or in the case of Dracula, I know you're in one of like 30 spaces. So it's, I mean, imagine Perilous Tales with, instead of 8 threat counters, it has 30 threat counters. And, you know, maybe there's a way of finding out whether that threat counter is empty or has got one of the 8 monsters in it. There's still a discrete sort of knowable element.
I think that's a stretch to say, you know, am I playing hide and seek with, you know, every other person in the world because I don't currently know where they are? No, because we're not within the specified boundaries of a game of hide and seek. There has to be specified boundaries of the game. If you say, oh no, you do know where Dracula is because he's not anywhere in the entirety of the universe, it's like, I think that's a pretty fallacious argument at that point. I think the point is that with Dracula, Fury of Dracula, with Mr. X in Scotland Yard, he could be in any of the spaces that a playing piece within that game is capable of being in, any one of them, right? Mm. With All Quiet on the Martian Front, the hidden movement pieces could not be in every single place that a miniature within that game could be in.
Yeah, not within the bounds of where that within that game could be, yeah.
Yeah, they can only be in a very, very, very limited number of places that a miniature could be in that game. Like given the range of actual positions a miniature could occupy in the average tabletop miniatures game, the hidden movement minis in All Quiet on the Western Front are part of an insanely limited set of positions that you could be in, given that you've got like a borderline infinite number of positions and they can be in like 3 of them. That's such a small subset of the available positions. It barely qualifies as being hidden movement.
Yeah, I just don't agree with that. Like in comparison to the analog movement, sure, but like that isn't necessarily a useful granularity with which to analyze that situation. Like once you know where Mr. X is on like the seventh turn or whatever, the eighth turn, like you then know for the next couple of turns he's within these sort of 12 different spots, and so you know he's in a radius around there, and the game has to give you that because that's the only way that it can make it feasible for you to get a bead on him. And so in a game, I can't remember the name of it, but one of the naval games that I've been reading, which has a submarine token, and the submarine token, there's some mechanic which means that the submarine can pop up anywhere within 6-inch sort of radius of that token. So that token describes an area within which the submarine is hidden. Like, I don't see that there's a vast amount of difference between defining an area of the table, whether that's 3 points or a 6-inch bubble, and the sort of 12 spaces in London that Mr. X could be after. Like, I still think it qualifies as having some of that tension of I need to make decisions in absence of complete information of where the units are, which I think is what, at least from a wargaming perspective, I think is what's the sort of interesting question that it's trying to put on the table. But I mean, obviously I take the point, it's a far cry from a full hidden movement, but I do think that there's a lot that can be achieved to replicate that sort of hidden information.
I think it's a tricky question, certainly. Okay, so here's one that I think might be more about the nature of pickup games.
Oh yeah.
And is, can you do co-op? And I know that obviously you can do co-op in Perilous Tales.
Mm-hmm.
You pick a group and you assign each person a member of that group, and then you play a game of Perilous Tales. The question is, can you do a tabletop miniatures game? Can you do almost any co-op game where someone can bring a non-trivially pre-built list to a pickup game and then play co-op with it? I think this is more of a mechanical moving parts meshing together question, but I think it's a non-trivial question as to whether I can have some sort of form of interesting list that is whatever qualifies as my force in the game turn up to a game sight unseen of what you have as your force, and then play cooperatively with you in a game that is then interesting to both of us. I don't know if that's like mathematically impossible to achieve, or just beyond the wit of man, or just not worth the headache that it would involve. But it's something I do wonder about.
Is there an assumption in that that if you turn up with a force and the other players have to play parts of your force, that's excluded from this scenario? Or if we turn up to play a miniatures game and there are 6 miniatures and we have to choose between them, I just choose the warrior and you choose the rogue, and that doesn't count? Like, I guess there's an assumption here that in order to be a miniatures game, it has to have some kind of force building element, and maybe that's
there's to say, I think
that's why it's making it difficult. But without it, I think you can have a perfectly good co-op miniatures game that does all the miniatures game inalienable things that we haven't yet identified.
I think if the game just gives you a force and says share this out amongst yourselves, it can totally do it. I think,
which feels more like a board game in a setup, like that just feels like a zombie side sort of situation, and so it feels weird. But then the game in front of you could be a 2x2 skirmish miniatures game with measures and miniatures.
Yeah, and I think the reason it's a sort of interesting question is that it's a question that asks you what things are relevant to defining this sort of genre. Is it like, okay, it has to only be about what you approach on the tabletop? All of the stuff that you do peripherally to approaching the tabletop is not part of these games. And they would say, okay, well, aside from the list building before approaching the tabletop, I definitely do a lot of model collecting and model putting together and model painting before coming to the tabletop. And the ones I collect and put together and paint are the ones that are part of my list. And so will if the game just goes, this is what you have to take because this is the preset force that this game makes you take because it has to be preset.
And if the models are pre-painted, if they're like little pre-painted Dungeons & Dragons things or pre-painted X-Wing ships.
Hmm. Yeah.
I think that's super interesting. I think at that point, like the tabletop experience of play would function as one of these games. But you wouldn't like, and you'd still have some post-match analysis where you'd be like, "Ooh, next time I get the cleric, I'm probably going to think about playing them in this different way." But you know, it misses out a lot of the preparation, both mental and sort of physical.
It would certainly feel like a very different sort of hobby game.
Which I think maybe just drags us a little bit back to the miniatures element, which is like okay, maybe I can make lots of churches and that's part of my physical preparation. But if I'm not making miniatures, am I engaging in the cycle of making enjoying my miniature tabletop game?
So do you need random chance in these sorts of games? Does there need to be some sort of random number generation, random element? Is it possible to make one that has no randomness whatsoever? And supplementary question, is it possible to make a good one that has no randomness whatsoever?
So one thing that I think is intriguing about this, I'll just attack this from the side temporarily. So I was thinking about, I've been playing a bunch of 90s collectible card games recently for reasons that I will, you know, I don't need to explain. Perfectly good. And one thing that's intriguing. One thing that's intriguing about most CCGs is that most CCGs have a purely deterministic resolution system for combat. So I play a card, you play a card, we look at the numbers, and one kills the other. You very rarely find, not completely absent, but you very rarely find a miniature game where, you know, I summon a goblin, you summon a yak, and then when they attack, we roll a dice to see, you know, how many wounds the yak takes, which would be how we would resolve it in a miniatures game.
Yeah.
We just take the stats as numbers that you add and subtract. But then, of course, there's a ton of randomness built into the fact that it's a deck of cards and things are coming off that deck in orders that are unpredictable. And so the randomness has been placed into another situation. And if you look, the obvious thing here is chess, where you've got an extremely discrete movement system and a vast but finite set of movement possibilities. And as the game gets, you know, closer and closer to the end, like the movements that matter become actually pretty limited numbers of analyzable movements that matter. And so I guess to some degree, like in answer to that question, if you took the randomness out of combat resolution, for example, but left fully analog movement, is that enough to create the sort of variety that a deck in a CCG is providing? It's not strictly randomness, but it's like, it's a vast probability space. And maybe at that point you have to make, you know, your deterministic combat system be very sensitive to distance, perhaps. So if I'm an inch and a half versus an inch away, that makes a difference for my attack. And then like exactly where I place the things becomes important, and that becomes an element of randomness.
Mm. Yeah, because, you know, obviously there's a difference between, you know, randomness, hidden information, and a level of complexity that I don't have access to. You know, and those three, one of those three things feels like they are necessary to keep a game interesting. And it's like noughts and crosses or tic-tac-toe is not interesting to me because I have a full understanding of every movement in the game. Whereas it is interesting to, like, you know, a six-year-old because they haven't yet figured out all the steps to it. Chess is interesting to me, but I could conceive of like some sort of higher alien being coming down from the stars and having the same opinion of chess that I have of tic-tac-toe. They're like,
I can see its totality. It is.
Yeah, I mean, I play chess with small children, obviously, but you don't play chess as a fully realized being.
Frufraklians play much more sophisticated and random games.
Yes.
We only play craps.
Yeah, chess has a sort of a bushiness that most human beings are not able to pare down usefully, and the fact that it's so difficult to control the arms of the bush is what makes it interesting. Now it feels like, given that tabletop miniatures games have infinite variety of movement, you can move something an infinite number of bits of an inch when you move it off the table, it feels like every tabletop miniatures game should have the potential to have more sort of bushiness than a game of chess, you know. And it feels sometimes like a lot of those games focus down onto nodes of activity. It's like a lot of this doesn't matter until these two models come into contact, and then you go through a little list of abilities you've built for them, and you match them off in a certain way, and that pairs out, and then you get a result. And it feels like it should be possible for those resolutions to be much simpler, and to just say, okay, here are, you know, if you played chess not on a chessboard, but in a place where everything can move in every direction and any distance, surely chess gets more complicated, doesn't it?
That's what X-Wing and Gaslands are trying to explore in their own way with their movement template systems. Is like, you can imagine playing chess on square bases where, you know, the knight has a little L-shaped thing and whatnot. But you'd need some non-discreteness in facings, for example, in order to make that.
I think one of the things that's interesting is, like, there's always these things where the next power of computer sort of solves chess, and then they've got one that sort of solved Go, and everyone's, oh, it'll never solve this game or that game. It's like, it definitely will. Computer definitely, definitely will solve all of those games. We're terrible at that sort of thing. Computers are amazing at it. Whereas if you look at a game like Dixit or Mysterium, I don't know that a computer will ever find that to be... That's a far more interesting question as to whether a computer can find that to be a solvable situation. And I think that to human beings, Warhammer seems like a much simpler game than chess, whereas I think probably a computer feels the exact opposite way. It's just that we have these weird brains that are more comfortable with the analog movement of things.
I genuinely don't know. I'm not a computer scientist, and my brain immediately goes to the impending or recent release of Warhammer, Total War Warhammer 3, where a computer has been steadily learning how to beat everyone at Warhammer for a while there.
I mean, every Warhammer computer game I've ever played is horribly easy to beat the AI. Right. Yeah.
There we go. Lay down the gauntlet. Glenn versus Total War Warhammer 3. Who will be victorious?
So I don't know. I don't know if they need random chance or not. And I don't know if they need random chance to be good.
Have you tried to write a chanceless war game per chance?
You know what? I've written one that's largely chanceless. That has very, very little randomness in it. And I don't know why I've always gone back to putting random chance in, if I'm brutally honest. It just feels like, putting miniatures in.
I think this is sort of the point for me, is that I've properly tried twice. And in both cases, I ended up putting it back in. And the reason was, it was just more fun. So I think, in answer to your question, like, is chance essential? I don't think it is. I think it can still be one of these games without chance. But I have yet to find a situation where that's better than having some chance put back into it.
We'll be back in just a second.
Okay, so I think there are two more, And I think these are possibly big ones. Next one, do you need victory conditions? Can you have a sandbox style RPG open-ended version of one of these games? I genuinely don't know that you can have one of these games that doesn't have a definitive end condition and a definitive sort of set of victory conditions.
You definitely can. The question is it any good?
I think the question is it still a game at that point, or is it just a thing you do and then the thing you stop doing?
I think this partly goes back to our conversation about is your game a game, which is a previous video. Go watch that one. Which is that it's sort of like a game without victory conditions is sort of a toy. It's a machine with a crank handle that I will either enjoy cranking that handle enough to make the experience of moving the pieces around worth my time, or it's simply a mechanical act for which I have no particular enjoyment. I mean, it's like, why do I like sorting out my Arkham Horror cards into binders? Like, there's no win state there.
And I mean, I know
I'm just engaging with the things that I like. There's some objects and I want to move them around and I want to think about, you know, wizards, and that's sufficient for me. I can't win at reading this sword and sorcery book.
No, look, I know what you mean. And there are plenty of things.
I'm not arguing with you. I'm just trying to imagine what one of these would feel like.
Yeah, and there are plenty of things, obviously, that I do that don't have win conditions. I mean,
but they're not games. You're not sold to them as games.
Well, no, but there is free play, and there are games I play, you know, that don't really have win conditions. You know, not as such. And one of, you know, I mean, obviously, when you put together and paint a miniature, there's not a win condition for doing that. So it's an inherent process.
I guess maybe, because my brain was going to the video game I'm currently playing, which is Elden Ring, which, like, it's a very, very long game with lots of things to do. And I don't yet know if there's a main storyline. Honestly, I'm trying to stay away from all the spoilers. But, like, as far as I can tell right now, like, I bump into a dude and I can kill him, and then I bump into another even monstrous dude and I can't kill him, and maybe I'll come back later and find a way of killing him. And so, much like finishing a miniature or finally killing this hairy goblin monster dude, like, there's a moment of satisfaction, which is not a win condition, but it's like a little rubber stamp of like, yes, did a thing. And that's part of a tapestry of other stuff that I'm up to. So I finish this miniature, great, brilliant, and maybe I finish another miniature, and that's part of that same thing. But it doesn't tell me when it's finished. It doesn't tell me that I have concluded the experience. It just tells me you have another way marker on your journey through this experience.
And the thing is, can tabletop miniatures games do that on any level? Because I mean, that obviously,
I really
something
think
like
must be able to.
I mean, something like Elden Ring has the bigness to it. It's big. It's going to have so many hours of gameplay that it can give you just way markers and things you discover.
But I think this exact thing is what Joe McCulloch is up to all of the time. Like in Rangers of Shadow Deep, and like less in Frostgrave, but still a bit in Frostgrave. Like Rangers of Shadow Deep is a solo game, so it sort of more pushes in this direction. It's like the purpose is to see one episode play out and then discover what happens to your crew. And I guess, like, his scenarios have win conditions because he's a sensible person writing a game that people will want to play. But you can imagine a version of that game where there's no win. I mean, hell, to be honest with you, like, Frostgrave is this. Like, there's no exit condition from a game of Frostgrave other than you walking off the table and running away. And so it's an organic loop where you enter the table, you decide how much of the game to engage with, and then you back out again going, haha, I've got some gold, or I've suffered sufficient wounds for me to want to limp off. And then you go through the process of finding out what happened to your dudes. And in some regards, like, I think you could pretty solidly argue that Frostgrave doesn't have a victory condition because it's totally urgent.
Frostgrave certainly has a situation where you've got all the gold and everyone else is dead. And at that point, hanging out on the, you know, just sitting there moving models.
No, but the game hasn't told you whether you've won or lost, or hypothetically it could say there's no reward for that situation occurring to you other than you walked off with the gold. And I suppose that's no more a win condition than like the game of life.
Well, I mean that's the thing, but if the game says, okay, I got all of the gold and you got none of the gold, and none of my people got hurt and all of your guys are dead, but there's no victory conditions. Oh, no. Yes, there are. I won and you lost, and everyone knows that I won and you lost. If all of your guys are dead and I've got all of the money, definitely I won. And just because somebody hasn't gone victory condition doesn't mean that there wasn't.
No, but that's just within the standard frame of computing victory. Like, one of the things I love about Blood Rage is that first time that you realize that there's a faction where you have to send as many of your warriors to Valhalla as possible. Like, maybe we're both playing Blood Rage and, you know, you've got all the gold, brilliant, I'm dead, brilliant, who's winning more? Well, it's me, because all my guys are in Valhalla, thank you very much.
But we're not playing Frostgrave, and I've got all the experience points and all the gold, and you've got nothing. Do you think you won that game?
That's not the point. The point is, in this hypothetical game, in this hypothetical version, I'm going to have to get it off the shelf and reread this very closely to find out if this is true. In this hypothetical version where the game hasn't told you whether there's a winner or a loser, then this is purely a social construct. It's not gamic.
I mean, you know, I can understand the idea that the overarching metagame of a campaign of...
sort of has no winners and losers.
Doesn't have a win condition. But the on-table top game of Frostgrave definitely has a winner and a loser. The winner is the person who has the most XP, the fewest wounds, and the most gold. And
your opinion, if the rulebook says
that... In the opinion
that,
of everybody with an opinion. Nobody thinks the person where everything's dead and they've got no money and no XP has won. Nobody thinks that.
I don't think there's a concept of a winner in this game. So in the scenarios, you get information about how to set up, and then you get information about what treasure and experience you get at the end. And the player that recovers the central treasure normally gets some extra little goodie, which, in some regards, you can consider that winning the game because you got the little special extra teddy, but it isn't called winning the game, and it's in no way framed in that way.
So are you saying...
And then in this ending the game section, it says, another way the game can end is if only one player has figures left on the table, blah, blah, blah. There's no mention of winning necessarily.
Yeah, but okay, so the overall campaign of Frostgrave has a version where you can ascend up to godhood, right?
Oh, sorry, look, in fact, may I read from this? In a campaign... there is no specific win condition for most scenarios, and each player is left to decide for themselves whether their wizard has, inverted commas, won or lost the encounter. So it's a social construct.
But the campaign has the opportunity to ascend to godhood, right?
It does, yeah. If one wished to play for that long.
Sure. I mean, look, every game you could take out the win condition, right? The question is, if Frostgrave...
Oh, no, yeah, exactly. And so the point is, he did... Is it still a miniatures game?
I mean, the thing, no, but what I mean
that's
is...
That's the interesting thing.
Has he? Look, what I would argue is I just think that it has different units of play that have victory conditions to them. Because the normal unit of play that gives you a victory condition is a game, whereas in this... Two models encounter each other. One kills the other one and gets experience for it, and the other one dies. the one that killed the other one was victorious. It just has a smaller unit of victory condition.
That's right, right, which is sort of where I was going with the Elden Ring comparison. It's like, I can have a series of interesting encounters and, like, for example, I could set up some models and I could play for a while and I could decide that three encounters is fun enough, or seven, or I'm still, you know, still got a bit of energy and I'll play another 12 encounters. And, like, it's sort of up to me to decide when I want to stop playing with the toy. But the toy keeps burping, like, little moments of satisfaction or sort of success as some reward cycle completes itself. Like, I rolled some dice and a guy died. Like, that's one little reward cycle. And so I suppose, does a game need victory conditions? I would argue, no, it doesn't. It needs a successful reward loop. It needs lots of reward loops adding up in concentric circles. Mm. But, like, does it need to determine who is the winner and who is the loser? I don't know. Maybe it goes back to your point. Like, it depends what level you're looking at. Like, on some level, yeah, it needs to determine a winner and a loser.
If our game
is about conflict, and I think all of our games so far have been about conflict, as all stories are.
Yeah, I guess it's how do these games achieve their reward loops? And can they achieve reward loops without an oppositional, you know, because even without victory condition, I beat you at doing a thing. That's my reward loop.
Yeah.
You try to do it, I try to do it, I'm more successful than you, I get pennies. You know, can they offer rewards in other ways? Are they fun in and of themselves? All right, the last one, it has to be the last.
Oh, this wasn't going to be a 30-minute conversation.
Well, you know, it could have been, but you persist in being wrong about so many things. you need line of sight or some form of, like, relative spatial relationship between your minis or markers.
Yes, and that, I do. I think that, this is the only one.
that to me feels like the fundamental definition of these sorts of games. I think that all of everything else can pretty much go by the wayside because they are add-ons or attachments or bits and pieces you don't need. But I can't begin to conceive of how something could be one of these sorts of games if it doesn't care about the relationship of this thing being here and that thing being there, and how they relate
between it that's obscuring them.
Yeah, and how they relate to each other in physical space and what that means for them, and making that relationship ask interesting questions and get the players to answer those interesting questions.
Because we were talking the other day about games with little squares that you put your dudes in.
Mm.
And I described, I think in the last video, that I was playing an old fashioned war game that I consider to be a war game because it's got little miniatures and you roll dice. And in that you have, as with Battletech or with Aeronautica, you have spaces that you can stand in and you can't be half in that space and half out of that space. It's a discrete movement system. But it matters where you draw, whether you draw a line of sight and it crosses a tower or it crosses a hill or whatever. Whereas a game like we were talking about, like Conan the board game or Imperial Assault or Warhammer Quest or Hero Quest. And I'm not certain about every one of those because I haven't played them all completely recently. But if all of those have a counting squares line of sight system, then they sort of don't count as one of these. I feel like at least one of them has a draw a line with a ruler, and if it crosses a piece of terrain, it gets blocked. I feel like Imperial Assault is maybe like that. So I think maybe, you know, if Imperial Assault, for example, has a granular line of sight thing, then that counts as one of these games almost, even though it's got a very discrete movement system.
Mm. Yeah, I think it needs to, on some level, be interested in something that addresses a very granular relationship between the spatial relationship between two player markers. I guess that would be the sort of the dictionary definition of what I think this sort of game is. It doesn't, you know, I'm not certain it always needs to be about line of sight per se, but at least needs to care whether they're in which direction they're encountering each other in, or how they put force projections on each other within a, you know, within a freeform tabletop.
Yeah, I mean, line of sight ends up being not quite the term you want in that situation, but like, you know, the fact that the abstracted ships in A Billion Suns have a front 180 arc, like the design reason for that is it's important because it matters then which direction ships are facing in, and you have to choose one or the other, and then there's a blind spot behind you. But like, it's not really line of sight. It's like, A, it's completely abstract game design, and B, it's like, well, computers looking at things that are miles away. Like, again, like, you might have a wizard who can, like, you know, shoot mind bullets through walls. The specifics of whether it's line of sight is not important. It's like it's whether or not they can draw a force projection between where they are and where this model is.
Yeah,
through whatever vagaries might obscure that force projection line.
Yeah, the manner in which two minis employ their force projection on each other has to be through sort of real physical space, has to at some point be non-abstracted, has to be something about whether it's because of it, they literally measure in millimeters from each other, whether they literally have to draw a line through a building, or whether they care about how the two miniatures encounter each other and in which direction and which alignment, there has to be something that has a sort of an absolute granularity to do with the spatial relationship between them.
And I think that's why instinctively at the beginning of this series of conversations, we were like, it's probably but not definitely about having measurements and moving your miniatures with measurements and being able to move up to or less than a thing. And I think this is the point that it gets to. It's like, it doesn't really matter if it's a movement template like an X-wing or a 3-inch and you choose to move 2.5. The point is, moving the extra half an inch is a decision that you're going to make because the subsequent relationships matter.
Yeah, I think a lot of the other questions we've talked about in this conversation are essentially questions of technology, as it were, the technology of the game design, and there are ways of getting around them or altering them or doing something with them or something adjacent to them. I think that that relative spatial relationship between the miniatures is what these games are, and I think if you take that out, they just would not be this sort of game. Everything else is a movable feast and one other form of window dressing, but that's the core of what makes this.
Oh, thank goodness we solved it. My goodness. I thought we were going to get there.
We can move on. So that
we
would
can
be
rest in our graves, Glenn.
Okay, I think we will finally sign off on this conversation. It went a touch longer than possibly anyone was expecting, but, you know, these things happen.
If you're still here, thanks for sticking around.
If you're still here, you obviously think that what we're doing is of some worth or value, and you're a hero, and we love you deeply.
Get to the end of this video, and you ever see me in real life, let me know that I promise to buy you a beer, and I will buy you a beer wherever we are.
Please, if you watch this point, like and subscribe. Drop us a comment in the comment section. Do you think that there's something we said wasn't an inalienable truth that was? Is there something you think is inalienable to these games that we entirely missed out? Do you think that these games don't need to have some form of granular spatial relationship between models? If so, what on earth do you think the game didn't have that would look like? I would love to get into that. If such a person exists,
battle chess,
please,
battle chess, Glenn.
For now, we will definitely sign off on this episode of Rule of Carnage. It's been great fun. It's always fascinating getting into these very deep delve and somewhat philosophical subjects. Hopefully we'll come up with something a little bit more concrete and simple for the next conversation.
Yeah, we'll rate our favourite goblin miniatures in the next conversation.
For now, we're going to sign off from this episode of Rule of Carnage. So bye-bye. Thank you. Goodbye. Bye-bye.